Hello. Thank you so much for being here at Scott Carney Investigates. I am so incredibly excited to have Professor Willoughby Britton on the show today. You know, I first met Willoughby, I think it was about 10 years ago when I was working on this book called The Enlightenment Trap, about how intense meditative experiences can have these really, really radically dangerous side effects that really no one wants to talk about. And I was scouring the world of academia looking for people who knew something about, you know, the dark side of meditation. And you can find thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of articles about all the ways that meditation can make you better and healthier and awesome in a number of ways. But what is missing mostly from the scientific literature and the clinical literature out there is how these things can also go horribly wrong, or at least just even just a little bit wrong. It seems like there's a taboo almost in talking about the downsides of meditation. So this conversation that we're going to have today explores this idea of spirituality in all of its complexity and all of its richness. We're not saying that meditation is bad by nature, but we do want to paint a full picture. And Willoughby is really the leader in this field, in the world, at least for this podcast. And she is also the director of a place called Cheetah House at Brown University, where she talks with people. You're a licensed therapist, right, Willoughby? A
clinical psychologist, well? Yeah.
Clinical psychologists, where people who've had these hard experiences in their meditative journeys, there are only a few places that really specializes, and Cheetah House is one of those places. So if you are somebody who's, you know, gone very deep in your meditations and something is not sitting with you, Willoughby is really the person to at least talk to you, or at least open the journey to give you the resources to sort of understand what you might be going through. So without further ado, Willoughby, thank you so much for being here. I really, really appreciate it. It really has been quite some time since I wrote The Enlightenment Trap. You know, I remember just coming to your house, Cheetah House at Brown, and just having this like really long, I think we talked for like 4 or 5 hours into the night about, you know, something that's really, really difficult, because I think we both got into meditation because we saw something really, really valuable in it. But there's also this dark side. So maybe you could just tell me why people are so hesitant to even broach the possibility that there is a dark side of meditation. Maybe we could define what that dark side might be as well.
Okay, well, maybe I should back up and tell kind of how I got interested in this topic. Sure. I mean, I sort of stumbled into this topic. Really, I was also, like most meditation researchers, a meditation enthusiast and evangelist and promoter. Mm-hmm. But when I did my dissertation study, which was looking at the effects of meditation on sleep as measured by brainwaves in a lab, you know, thinking without any hesitation that meditation was going to improve sleep, when I got the data back, it basically caused cortical arousal, you know, insomnia in everyone. Oh, and
in everyone.
Well, in the meditation group, you know, as a whole, but mm-hmm. more than on average, you know, significantly higher than the control group who didn't meditate. So mm-hmm. And then when I'm guilty of this thing that you're talking about already. Like, I didn't publish that data because I was like, okay, this is the wrong answer. It's not promoting meditation. So I won't publish it. And then, you know, during that time that I wasn't publishing it, I went on a meditation retreat and I sort of was telling this teacher about these findings, and she kind of chastised me and said, you know, I don't know why all you clinical psychologists are trying to make meditation into a relaxation technique. Everyone knows if you meditate enough, you stop sleeping. And so
Whoa.
I thought, okay, well, one, you know, what are the assumptions that we're making? as researchers and often clinically oriented healthcare providers, when we use meditation as sort of a health promotion device, are we missing something? Are we kind of making assumptions? Because it really wasn't designed for that initially, mm-hmm. at least in Buddhist practices. It had a little bit of a different, or a lot of a different, you know, mm-hmm. origin story than for health benefits. So that was one question. And then the second question was, you know, what else do meditation teachers know that they're not telling researchers?
Yeah.
And so that was in 2006. And then in 2007, I transferred to Brown from the University of Arizona to do my clinical internship, which is a residency. And my placement is at Butler Hospital, which is an inpatient psychiatric hospital in Providence. And during that 1 year residency, there were two yogis who came off retreat in Western Mass, completely psychotic.
Wow.
And so I was like, wow. Go ahead. What?
I'm going to interrupt you, but we're going to get right back into this. I'm just thinking is that when you said, you know, what else are these meditation teachers not telling us, or that we're or the message that we're not getting? It's sort of like that's the fantasy, though, right? The fantasy is that when you learn meditation, you will find these other secrets that the meditation teachers don't let you in on. And that's one of the draws of meditation, that you can go deeper and deeper and deeper. But what you're saying is, yeah, this is like an open secret. And why, it's our fantasy of meditation, which is so problematic. And if you could just tell me, what tradition of person were you talking to? Because, you know, when we say meditation, obviously there's thousands of techniques. I don't know, like a bunch of techniques.
I mean, I have a general policy to be very ambiguous about the who's of my stories, but I will just say that this is like, I practiced in, you know, the Western Insight tradition, which is loosely tied with Theravada Buddhism.
Okay.
So Western Insight teacher, that's who we're talking about. So I had two psychotic yogis, meditators, at my inpatient psychiatric hospital. And I went back to this same teacher and was like, explained what I saw. And I'm like, have you ever seen this before? And I just remember that I never got a verbal answer. I just got this look that was kind of like, oh shit.
Oh, really?
Like, it was like, yeah, it was kind of like, yeah, we know about that. And I wish you hadn't asked, kind of thing.
Sorry, I was not interrupt.
So of course I'm like, whoa, there's a story here. I mean, if I had been a journalist, I would have been like, okay, like so, this is something. So that conversation, or that sort of series of events, which took a couple years, actually became the beginning of the Varieties of Contemplative Experience study, which was basically like just going to different meditation centers. I was already like that discussion was basically started to be the first interview. You just go to meditation centers,
right?
You talk to the teachers that have been there and teaching there for decades. And you ask them, like, what kind of challenges have you observed in your students? What do you make of them? How do you interpret them? And then what do you do about it? You know, what very practically, like, what's the response? And so that was
Why would you say that he didn't want you to ask that question?
Well, another teacher, that was a woman, by the way. But another teacher that I talked to, also a very famous Dharma teacher, both have written many books. When I went to talk to this other teacher about various things I was seeing, that teacher also looked not surprised and like kind of nodding and looking almost bored by the like this array of symptoms that I was describing. And I was like, you know about this. Like, how come, you know, you've written all these Dharma books. Like, how come you didn't publish this in any of your books? And he was like, well, it's not good advertising.
Oh my God. This is like the problem in the world, Willoughby. We want to be able to go into esoteric traditions and say there's wisdom there that we can collect. And yet, as we do that, as sort of Western professionals, we're also aware of this specter of people saying, that's all woo-woo. That's all crazy stuff. And so we feel this desire to sort of like overboost the, and I'm saying we in a sort of more collective way, right? We Westerners who are into meditation, but we want to like sort of protect that thing that we're going to by ignoring some of the dangers that go with it. It seems like a pattern that's over and over again. I don't know if you've seen what's been going on with Wim Hof and I, but there's all these deaths that now I'm talking about associated with the Wim Hof method. And the world is so upset that I'm bringing this out because they're like, no, but this is so good. The cold water and the breath work save everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question that you're asking, which is why are people being so resistant to this after, you know, almost 20 years of doing this research and getting like extreme pushback, which I think is very odd, an odd thing to do, mm-hmm. like to talk about, you know, risks and benefits of any treatment, like that should just be like regular standard science. I mean, that's just part of what you do. The fact that we're getting such strong pushback, that itself is so interesting to me that now it's become a research mm-hmm. question. Well, why are people pushing back so much? Because if you say like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy has side effects.
Right. Obviously it does.
Or Prozac, you know, they're mm-hmm. like, yep, they do. And like, we have this long list of drug effects and they're required to list them on every single package. And like, so what? That doesn't deter mm-hmm. people from taking it. My research is not going to deter the millions and millions and millions of people meditating.
Right.
It's just going to help them do it in a more informed way. So yeah. So what is that about? And so I think there are, you know, lots of different possible answers. One of them, the most obvious one is financial conflict of interest. So right. a number of people are making money off of their meditation products. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this behavior, like a brand defense kind of strategy, all of the same strategies that you would find in a brand defense strategy, you know, playbook mm-hmm. are being used in the meditation Absolutely. Industry. So I'm seeing, you know, it's not the meditation, it's the user. It's user error, or mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's a pre-existing condition trying to unlink the right. the harm with the product, you know, saying that the harm is actually a benefit. Like back, if you go back into big tobacco, they actually said that coughing was good for people.
Because, I mean, they would have sold cancer as being good for people if they
could. Yeah, they said coughing was good for people because it would help like bring up stuff, you know, which is exactly the same thing we're hearing in the meditation industry. Like, oh, all these bad things, you know, negative experiences, traumatic memories that are getting flooded through your system. Well, these are all good things because you're working out your trauma or your karma. So I see. So there's actually a great book called, Industrial Strength Denial, which goes through the brand defense strategies of all these different industries, including tobacco and big pharma and the auto industry, and, you know, kind of classifies all these brand defense. So that's like one really disheartening answer, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. but also like seems to be pretty accurate. And then the other is just, you know, also a conflict of interest, but not necessarily financial, which is that when something has helped you and you are relying on it to be mm-hmm. kind of your refuge mm-hmm. And your buffer to, you know, death anxiety and life existential doubt and crisis, when somebody says, oh, that thing isn't perfect, that becomes extremely threatening and people will lash out. Like, that's why I'm like, why are you lashing out with like a life or death kind of like survival response at me? You know, like it doesn't need to be that intense.
Why do you immediately go into fight or flight when basically you're saying like, I am in control of my emotions, and yet you poke the thing that they their tool, and all of that mental training seems to just go out the window.
Well, and also, like, you know, Buddhists in particular are very kind of condescending or you know, on their high horse about being more compassionate than everyone else too. And so I was like, well, some Buddhists have a, like, plenty of aggression. I have a stalkers and haters, two separate folders with more than 1,000 emails on them from people who just come after me and just like can't hold back. I mean, go look at my Dalai Lama quote, like my Dalai Lama interview when I gave my talk to him, and it's like on YouTube and people can make comments. It.
Oh my God. Wait, what's it say? Give me the quick summary.
I try not to read them because they actually do hurt my feelings. By the way, everyone, I do actually have feelings and I actually am a person. Like, I'm not made of titanium. I don't know. I just read one that said something like, this is a conversation between an ignorant lady, me, and, you know, a wise blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just like, let's make it really simplistic, you know?
Right. I'm sure that was the lightest one. As a common peruser of my own internet comments, you know, leave a comment in the video down below. And, you know, you get so much, there's so much sort of out of the box hate that exists there. But rather than go down that path, I want to ask you, let's actually get into like a little bit of that evidence. What can you tell me of, what are the symptoms of what are some of these negative symptoms that you observe other than someone being admitted to Butler? What might happen to somebody who goes intensely into meditation? If we could just give like a quick rundown. Yeah. Well, and there's like 30 years of your career compacted into no more than 3 minutes. If we could.
Yeah. And you're wondering why no one knows about this. It's the journalists play a role there. And that's one of the problems is that you guys are like, give me a soundbite. And I'm like, no, there isn't a soundbite. This is complicated. Deal with it. So in the Varieties of Contemplative Experience study, we documented 59 categories of meditation-related challenges across 7 different domains. And so I'll go through the domains, the cognitive domain, is basically anything related to thinking. And I would say, you know, it could be your thoughts speed up to like an insane pace, or they disappear altogether. So there's like no thoughts at all. We call that mind emptiness. Or you could like have the ability, you lose the ability to form concepts. So it's concept loss. So for example, there was a woman in our study that was leaving retreat and driving, which is not a good idea, by the way, but, you know, and got to a red stoplight and saw that it was the color red, but couldn't register, like, couldn't remember what red meant. Did it mean stop or go? Luckily, there was another car in front of her that stopped, and so she didn't run the red light. But that's concept loss. And then there's also delusions, which would be, you know, having really, you know, false ideas about things. So that's cognitive. And that can kind of bleed into psychosis. Perceptual changes, probably the most common, you know, early thing that's not necessarily an adverse effect, but just is perceptual hypersensitivity. So you tend to see your colors get brighter. The sounds get more, suddenly you hear the clock ticking on the wall, you hear your own breathing, you hear your own blood in your ears, you know, like you just get more sensitive. And that might not be a problem unless it starts, you know, when you come back to the city and then suddenly you hear every car door slam, you hear like the, you know, the traffic feels like something's driving right through your body. So that can be too much. Eventually that same process, and we've written some papers about the neurobiology of this, but eventually that same perceptual hypersensitivity process can lead to, you know, outright hallucinations in any modality. It could be visual, but it could also be, you know, auditory or even motor, like you could have tics or something like that.
Kriyas, they would call them in the
Kriyas. Yeah, that's in the somatic domain. So it's not quite. Yeah. In the emotional domain, affective domain, the most common emotion that we see is fear. So something in the fear spectrum, anxiety, fear, paranoia, that kind of thing. You can also see really any kind of emotion, just like on steroids kind of thing. And then also, you know, re-experiencing of past, you know, traumas or stressful events. So flooding of that. And then you can also see the opposite. So on one hand, too much emotion, and then also loss of all emotion altogether. So we call that affective blunting. And then in the somatic domain, probably one of the most interesting, because there's not really a category for it in science that we know of, is the what we call ELSAs, energy-like somatic experiences. So people have these sensations in their body that feels like electricity, energy, pressure, movement. So we wrote a whole paper about that, about the different metaphors people use for that. But that one tends to be really annoying and very, not more than annoying, it's like disabling. People like are unable to work or do anything. It's so overwhelming. Somatic can also be like changes in appetite or insomnia is also super common.
It's so interesting because everything you're saying as a negative symptom is also things that I've heard described as positive symptoms. Like, oh, that person is a really good energy worker. They can move energy through their bodies is something that I hear fairly regularly in the meditation community. Or the idea that, oh, this will heighten your senses so that you can hear more things. Like there's all these positive spins on these, but what you're saying is you're seeing those same symptoms, but they make it maladaptive for the person. The person is so hypersensitive that all of this stuff is too much.
I really want to answer that question, but I have to like just finish my list before I get distracted.
Okay,
That's a really, really important next step. So after somatic, we have cognitive, which is just changes in motivation. So some people get like, you know, enlightenment or bust tattooed on their forehead, you know, not literally, but you know, families and go like, go on retreat. And then other people just lose all motivation altogether and like literally sit and stare at a wall for 2 years and like don't do anything. And then the next domain is the sense of self, which is a huge one. It would probably do an entire podcast just unpacking changes in sense of self. I teach an entire class on it with my husband, Jared Lindahl. But there's a lot of different changes in sense of self. But often around loss of sense of self. And this is a really good example of what you're talking about because, you know, losing your sense of self, you know, ego death or ego dissolution is a highly sought after effect of many different types of spiritual practices. So, you know, how do you know when is it not, you know, so this is, right. so the issue of appraisal, became a really, really big piece of the
variety. When you say appraisal, what does that mean?
So the issue of what is an adverse effect? What makes it adverse and who gets to decide? And so we found that question actually became really kind of pivotal and that of the 59 categories, there weren't really any, except for maybe suicidality, there really weren't any that every single person who had the experience and every single teacher that we interviewed all said this was a bad thing. There wasn't one single category that was like that, but every category, there were some people that said this was bad for me. And the other, and then, so there was, so every single experience, we called them potentially challenging experiences because the same experience could be positive in one person and negative in another. It could be positive in the same person in one context and negative in another. So mm-hmm. a lot of these experiences, when they happen on retreat, which is if you haven't ever been on a meditation retreat, it's extremely boring. There's nothing going on. There's nobody talking. It's silent. You're usually at this place yeah. where all of your needs are met. All you have to do is show up for the meditation, you know, sitting, and then you don't even put your shoes back on. You just pad over to, you know, the food, and then you get fed. And it's very, you can have a pretty high level of cognitive dysfunction and still like manage to do the retreat.
Right. That's a really good point. That's the retreat creates the environment where you're just having one experience, which is what they want you to have, yeah. but it doesn't show how you integrate in society. And, you know, just to bring up this, you know, you mentioned suicide on these retreats. I mean, the way I got into this was, of course, doing a meditation retreat in 2005, where I was leading an abroad program through North India. And one of my students on a Tibetan retreat at an FPMT retreat in Bodh Gaya, one of my students committed suicide at the end of the retreat, and her journal sort of indicates she was a bodhisattva. And like, that was like the starting point for me realizing, going from the moment is like, oh, meditation's great. It's going to make me a great snowboarder or whatever. Like, you know, that like sort of like a very dumb understanding of what meditation was about, to suddenly seeing this drastic consequence of somebody not killing themselves, not because they were, dissatisfied with things, that because they had some sort of overwhelming grief, but because they were supposedly enlightened, they were supposedly at some sort of spiritual moment of transcendence. You know, that's like the whole thing of my enlightenment trip, and I reprint a lot of her journal in that, because I want people to understand how difficult it is to grapple with these ideas, because you're told when you're meditating that you're going to have experiences which are greater than yourselves, that's unusual. And depending on the tradition, these can be much more magical traditions than other traditions. You know, so there's sort of just a big continuum of what's out there. And there's also this idea that you can accumulate superpowers. Like if you go to certain meditation organizations, you're like, you can get super hearing. You can become impervious to the cold. You can be telepathic. You can levitate, you know, transcendental meditation. Like there's this big levitating component to it. And all of that plays into exactly what you're talking about here. And then in addition, you're also bringing up, you know, just even exploring your mind creates this, you know, hypersensitivity is a really interesting question, right? Because when you become very aware of things that are going in your mind, that is sort of the goal and also the problem.
You that just threw like 20 things at me. Which one would you like me to answer? I mean,
this is just free form. Just tell me what comes into your mind.
I mean, I think that let's just say a little bit about suicide, because I don't often publicly, or I don't even think I've ever talked publicly about suicide. And the reason I'm not particularly proud of, but it's really because one of the tropes that like I get attacked with is kind of like the hysterical woman trope, that I'm a fear mongerer and I'm doing all of this for attention, and that I'm over the top, you know, that I'm sensationalizing these experiences, which I'm totally not, because I don't even talk about the suicides, and there are too many, and there are so many, in fact, that we have to have an entire special group at Cheetah House for parents.
Oh my God.
Of children, or, you know, young adults that have gone on retreats and killed them, not come back.
What do numbers look like? Are you able to give me sort of a figure of what this actually is?
No, I don't think we really know, but I mean, I know I can count five on my hand, like pretty much right off the top of my head, that I know about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Even in the Vinaya, so when the Buddha was teaching meditation, right, originally, in the Vinaya, there's this story of the Migalandika, which is one of his monks, where 500 monks in the sort of the very first in writings on Buddhist meditation all committed suicide or were murdered by Migalandika because they were doing an intensive form of meditation. And at the end of that story, and this is in the Pali Canon, at the end of that story, the Buddha says, well, maybe we shouldn't do this really intensive type of meditation, which at that point was meditating in charnel grounds and graveyards and watching corpses decay. Very intense and related to a Tibetan tradition called Chut, which is out right now, which is still, you know, in the consciousness. After that, the Buddha was like, no, let's just focus on breathing. It's way better to do breathing, which is such a fascinating story to me. And I love this story because it shows that the Buddha can make errors, right?
Right. It's self-correct. Like, great. Can we keep doing that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And it's in the liturgical tradition, right? It's like, it's not just you, Willoughby, saying that there could be problems. It was the Buddha saying right. this. So,
well, and also just say that, you know, these experiences, these intense experiences, are documented in all three major schools of Buddhism. You know, mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism calls them nyams. There's the whole Zen sickness or meditation sickness of Zen. Theravada Buddhism has the stages of insight with some really harrowing stages that are known to be pretty challenging. So there are, and they don't agree, by the way, on whether these are a problem or whether they're progress either.
Right. Well, so, you said stages, and I'm like, well, someone's just going to hear stages. They're like, well, you didn't get right. through stage four, but stage five, you're going to be okay. You just got stuck because you did it wrong, right? That's right. sort of the...
So, I mean, we know... So, yeah. These are well documented in Buddhist texts. These are... So that's another reason why people should just know about it. Just have informed consent about what they're getting into. Just be more informed.
And now word from our sponsors, by which I mean you. Thank you for being here. And I wanted to say, if you really like the stuff that I do, it would be great if you could support the show on Patreon, where you'll get early access to new videos and a lively community talking about, well, the weird things that I talk about on this channel. It would mean a lot for me if you could check out the link down below and, you know, see if this is right for you. But if it doesn't, you know what really also helps me? If you like and subscribe and hit that bell icon, the algorithm really, really cares. And it gives a massive boost to let my channel spread all over the internet. And without further ado, back to the video. Let's get into the like the goals of someone who gets into meditation in the first place. Usually you go there seeking something, right? Most, especially in the Western tradition, right? We're not raised in it. Usually it's something that you're raised in either an atheist or in a religious tradition. They're like, oh no, let's go into Buddhism. So they're obviously seeking something. And there's something called like a Kundalini awakening that you read about all the time. Could you tell me what a Kundalini awakening is?
I mean, Kundalini awakening is kind of like, it's like the fibromyalgia of, or autoimmune disorder of the spiritual world, i.e. it is a garbage category that like everybody just throws everything into when they don't really know what's going on. So I think there's probably like a clean Kundalini, you know, where it's very specific, where it's like just, you know, heat or sensations like going up the spine. And that's like, you know, there's something very specific. But if you look at the way the word Kundalini has been used in the sort of literature, mm-hmm. it's everything is Kundalini. And so I don't find it particularly helpful. And also when people who get into meditation for largely secular reasons, to manage their stress, to help them manage their emotions, to work through grief or loss, when they start to have symptoms and then somebody says it's Kundalini awakening and now they have to like deal with chakras and gurus and you know, Reiki, that itself can be such a terrifying idea that it doesn't tend to be a super helpful category for most people that I see. For other people, you know, who have, who really want a spiritual interpretation, then it can be somewhat useful. But, I think there are some other, like there's a book called Gopi Krishna. It's on one of my bookshelves back there. And he has like, I forget what they're called, but one of them's called like Living with Kundalini. And then it's like, you think that that's his only book, but then it's like 10 years later, he writes another one that's basically like still living with Kundalini, you know? And it's like, oh boy, like that's a long time to have these intense symptoms. And they're very, very difficult, you know, to the sort of classic Kundalini, which is like all these energies, you know, the Elsas.
It's interesting. There's something here that I've talked about on other episodes of my podcast where I talk about the difference between a disease and diagnosis and the way we think about things just in the Western medical tradition. But, you know, in this, when we're talking about something in an esoteric tradition, in a meditation tradition, such as they give diagnoses for this spiritual sickness. For instance, in the Tibetan tradition, there's also this thing called lung, which is wind disease. And it's like your chakra winds get, you know, they're going all over the place in the wrong order and bad things happen. It's fascinating to me, the way you're positioned in this is that you're taking a Western clinical approach, and there's also this other esoteric approach. They're both recognizing the same condition. How do the treatments vary between those in the Buddhist traditions or the Hindu traditions and the Western clinical paradigm?
So, I mean, I think, you know, meditation itself is positioned in this very interesting place where on one hand, it's offered as secular, mm-hmm. scientific, you know, neuroscientific. Mm-hmm. It's often compared with, you know, different kinds of drugs as having a, you know, can you know, antidepressants or, you know, Ritalin. It can be compared to different kinds of drugs as, you know, being a better treatment. So it's playing all the roles of a medical treatment. Mm-hmm. When it's convenient, and then when it's, you know, when it's also convenient, it can also be by the same people presented as, you know, a magical sacred practice that can't be captured mm-hmm. by science. Mm-hmm. And so that switch often happens when bad things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody's like going to, you know, they're going to this like mindfulness class and it's secular and it's scientific, and then bad things happen and they're like, oh, you're experiencing, you know, Kundalini. And they're like, what? Mm-hmm. What are you talking mm-hmm. about? You said it was secular. What is Kundalini? So that's right. Like, and then that's called institutional betrayal, and that's like another kind of trauma. So that's a whole other thing that happens. But so, you know, it's obviously we're going down. It's a hornet's nest of complexity. Right. But I, as somebody who works with people who are in some ways victims or patients, right. I try to take their perspective and I try to be advocates for them. So I'm going to answer your question, but I just want to caveat the hell out of it, just like a good scientist, which is basically like, I want to know how that person is experiencing it and interpreting it. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is, you know, the authorities, whether they're medical authorities or whether they're spiritual authorities, basically step in and be like, I will interpret that for you and now determine the rest of your life. Because if I determine it, you know, regardless of what you think, this is a spiritual awakening and you may not medicate it, which means that you will have these energies surging through your body for the rest of your life and you will not be able to work or take care of your family. Like, too bad, that's your spiritual calling.
Whoa.
You know, it's like, whoa, does this person get any vote in their life? Yeah. You know, do they want mm-hmm. that? Mm-hmm. Do they even believe in that? So I want to be able to give power back to the person who has to actually deal with it, which is the experiencer.
Right.
And so, you know, so I always, when I'm asking people, when they come to Cheetah House, I always ask like, well, how are you making sense of this? You know, mm-hmm. what interpretive frameworks that you've been offered, like, are resonating with you and which ones are not resonating with you? And I mm-hmm. often find, and I can, you know, I'm probably a biased source because people see my website and my degree and they're like, oh, she's a neuroscientist, I'm going to her. So I probably like only see, one group of people, but people tend to be pretty freaked out by the spiritual interpretations mm-hmm. and pretty, you know, put at ease when there can be a biological explanation. So that's my huge caveat.
Sure. Okay.
And then in terms of, you know, like I said, the different schools of Buddhism have words for these same experiences that we documented. However, they don't all agree whether they are things to be intervened upon or whether they are signs of progress. And so you can't say that there's like a spiritual interpretation and then a medical one, and that all the spiritual ones say, oh, this is good, this is part of the path, because they don't. There are many, like I said, Zen has something called meditation sickness, which is considered a problem, mm-hmm. something to be intervened upon. There are certain kinds of problems, like you mentioned, lung in Tibetan Buddhism. You know, stop meditating if you have lung. Like, that is not mm-hmm. something that you want to continue. It's not going to get better on its own. So mm-hmm. it really depends on the symptom and the tradition, mm-hmm. how it's going to be treated. But I would say that often, or more often, there are places where certain kinds of experiences are normalized or expected and are not necessarily grounds for concern or intervention. Mm-hmm. And so that would be one sort of difference, is that it does tend to be more normalized within spiritual traditions. But also, you know, I think that to some extent that is sort of back to where we started. We're like, why are people getting so mad at me for calling out harms? Which is that spiritualizing is a really easy way to deflect any claimed of harm. You're not
spiritual
having
spiritual bypassing is the
way. Well, you're
the
you know, spiritual that. Bypassing is when you know, take up a meditation practice to avoid, or get super spiritual to avoid all of your like regular actually human true. Messiness and milestones. This is another kind of spiritual bypassing where it's basically spiritualizing in order to deflect liability.
Right, to protect the actual institution.
Yeah.
Which in some cases is started, you know, in many of these cases that we're talking about, these traditions start in medieval periods, sometimes even ancient periods, in an ancient context of a monastery or a person by a tree. And like, we're taking these concepts and we're migrating them to the modern world, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Like, lots of ancient things migrate to the modern world just fine. But not all of them, right? And just because something was really adaptive to be a madman living under a tree, having no thoughts, might have been okay in some instances in the 600s in Nepal, it doesn't necessarily make you it work well when you are an investment banker or a mindful sniper, right? That's a big category now. Like, or these people who are like trying to take that old tradition and put it in an entirely novel context.
Yeah. I mean, all of those are, yes.
Willoughby, I'm sorry. I keep on hitting you with these things that are like so big. And you're like, Scott, in order to talk about this, really, we need to go in depth and break apart all of your concepts.
I mean, I'm a slow. If slow science isn't a thing, I just invented it. I'm into slow science, which is like deeply thinking about all of these issues like so thoroughly. Yeah. The varieties of contemplative experience study took us 10 years. It's 3,000 pages of transcripts, and we're still publishing things. And it's like, you know, I really think about all these things that you're throwing at me, like really deeply. but they're all, you know, they're all hugely important. So let's just keep unpacking.
Well, I guess we can do like a 4-hour podcast to see where this goes. We're digging in. We're putting on our pajamas. We're going for it. All right. One thing I want to try to understand, at least for myself, this is one of the questions that comes up over and over again, is the difference between a spiritual experience. So in the yogic tradition, we have things called siddhis. These are miracles, right? You're sitting down with a teacher and they do something that surprises you and makes you amazed. And I believe that you've hung out in India a little bit. I remember 10 years ago, we were talking about visiting yogic masters in caves, because I think we've both done this in our 20s, where you meet these people who are like, you know, like sort of recluses, but then they do something which just mind boggles you. And there's this performance of the miracle, or the really big insight. I'm sitting here, I'm meditating, and I shoot down a tunnel of light and I see a bearded guy. I've done that too, right? And then there's also the ethical considerations. Did seeing that bearded guy at the end of the tunnel make me a better person, or was it just an experience of seeing a bearded guy at the end of a tunnel? How do we unpack that sort of distinction between these two things?
Oh boy, this is another big one. So when is an experience a religious experience, or when is it a spiritual experience? What makes it that way? Mm-hmm. So we wrote a paper on this, actually two different ones. One is called Progress or Pathology, which is how to differentiate, you know, a sort of expected spiritual experience from something that needs intervention. And then we also we wrote a chapter in the Oxford Handbook of Meditation on this exact question, like how have other people, you know, looked at this question? So basically what we found, echoing other people, was that the experience itself, the phenomenology, isn't what people use to determine that.
What do you mean?
So it's not the experience itself that, like the category of experience, whether that determines whether it's religious or not. Mm-hmm. What determines whether it's religious are a whole host of other things that are sort of secondary or contextual to the experience.
And when you say religious, what do you mean? So my anthropology neurons just fired.
Oh,
like
boy.
When you said something is religious, do you mean supernatural? Is that sort of, or do you mean like liturgical? Like, you know, this is the tradition.
Oh boy. So, I mean, my husband is a religious studies scholar and they're still arguing about the definition of religion, you know, at the American Academy of Religion. So yeah. I am probably not the person to be asking this.
Anthropologists still don't know what cultural is. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those fuzzy categories, but I think that like maybe another way to say it would be like that certain experiences are special. Mm-hmm. They're different than other experiences, and mm-hmm. they are of high value. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would be a way to say it. And so what we've found is that there's an experience, and then there's a process of appraisal that this experience is spiritual.
Okay.
And that of value and special and all that stuff. And that process of deciding that is not determined by the experience itself. Okay. I mean, there is, so, and I can, and I've gone through every, you can go through all 59 categories of my, you know, of my study. I think the one around changes in sense of self, especially like mm-hmm. losing all of your boundaries between yourself and the world or yourself and other people, that's classically like what Stace or Hood would call sort of a mystical experience, like having mm-hmm. sort of a oneness experience or emerging with the mm-hmm. world. Also found that there were plenty of people in our study that found that that was an extremely terrifying and dysfunctional experience, not at all mm-hmm. something that they wanted to repeat ever again. And they mm-hmm. definitely wanted it to stop. But that's, you know, and also some people had positive experiences of that too. I don't want to say it's all negative, but so there's not really any experience that is itself like, aha, that one is a religious experience. Ah, that's a spiritual experience. It's not the experience mm-hmm. itself. It's the context. I mean, I've heard people say like anything that happens on a meditation retreat, because it's happening on a meditation retreat
has to be good.
Is a spiritual experience. And I'm like, that mm-hmm. makes no sense.
Because you've set an intention for this to be a sacred space, right? That then, therefore, everything that fits into that container of sacred space must by definition be sacred. But does that mean it's a good thing or not? I mean, I think one of the things that I come to when I think about the Buddhist or even the Christian tradition, right? If I saw someone walking on water in a Christian tradition, you know, we've got Jesus, we've got this thing. And therefore, because they did something impossible, right? Or I had this vision, which was impossible because it was outside of my normal perception of reality. Therefore, everything that is said in the tradition must also be true, right? I find this to be it's sort of a hook, right? In a way, whether you, if you can perform the miracle, then therefore everything that person, that teacher gives you must be true. And then you get into things like, what's the word? It has just lost me in Sanskrit. It's the idea that, you can lie, you can do magic tricks, you can do things to trick somebody to believe there was a miracle. Therefore, it's called upaya, right? This is the word in Sanskrit.
Oh, like, skillful means.
Skillful right. means, right? I skillfully convinced them to believe everything I said because I lied to them. And then, you know, in the beginning, you're amazed by something. And then later you become the protector of the lie, right? You're brought in. It's like, no, you've seen the other things I've given you. Now you must protect the lie for everything. You know, Stephen Batchelor has a great book on this as well. You know, the truth I had to lie for something.
Yeah, I mean, I see that a lot with, you know, if your meditation class or program like beats the control group, mm-hmm. you know, on a single variable, therefore Buddhism is true. You're like, no, that's not science. Follow. No.
Yeah, it's sort of like when you say like there were significant results, and you're like, do you mean statistically significant? Because that doesn't mean what you think it means. It doesn't mean substantial. It means yeah, we beat the control group by like, you know, 0.04%.
Well, and just you know, just for your listeners, when a study finds that any treatment is better than a control group. In a, you know, hopefully it's a randomized control trial. If it's not, you can just stop listening, you know, better be an RCT. But that's, you know, it's a good start, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that thing is going to work for you. Mm-hmm. You know, these are based on averages, and there's always going to be people that didn't benefit from the treatment. There's always going to be people that probably got worse. Mm-hmm. It's a good sign that probably most people got better or didn't get worse, but you can't base individual treatment protocols on averages. So, mm-hmm. you know, and it definitely doesn't generalize past the group that you're talking about. And it definitely doesn't have anything to say about a world religion's veracity.
Right. Although it's presented like that continually, right? You know, we look at right now, so I just did this book on dreaming that I have coming out very soon. And I delved into some meditations on dreaming, like yoga nidra. That was something that I was very interested in. And I found it was actually pretty cool. Like I did yoga nidra and I felt pretty good afterwards. And my subjective experience, I think, is worth saying that, yeah, other people could do this too, and it's probably going to be good. But the way that we've also framed it as, because it, right now it's like the buzzword, right? Yoga nidra is like the thing that everyone's doing. There is actually so little science on it. Like there's so little actual useful science, and the couple that have been done, can you imagine doing yoga nidra in an MRI machine with all the clicking and the banging and all of that? Like what is actually going on? It proves very difficult to study. And just because you find a mechanism whereby something might work, it doesn't mean that says anything about consciousness itself. I mean, you start like getting into all these really thorny questions where you're going to need, like, it's not like you couldn't answer these questions scientifically. You could always develop a hypothesis and test the hypothesis, but we're nowhere close to what we need to find anything like truth. What we have is a great way to get hype.
Yes. And hype is really not helping the meditation industry. They think it mm-hmm. is, but it's actually going to just eat it up and swallow it and spit it out. It is, mm-hmm. you know, like just making this thing, it's already happening, you know, with mindfulness. So mindfulness mm-hmm. started off like when I started in 2000. So over mm-hmm. 20 years ago, I started doing research in mindfulness, and it slowly kind of hit a peak of being a panacea and good for everything. And now mm-hmm. people are like, you know, it's pretty good, you know, but it's not good for everything. And the sort of hype has waned. And I think we're moving actually into a much more mature place. Mm. Where we can engage with it in a much more like level-headed way. Like, it's a good tool. It's everyone should have this tool in their toolbox, but you can't use it for everything. But then there's always a new guy on the scene. So right now it's psychedelics, and psychedelics can do everything, you know, so.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Willoughby, I avoided using the word psychedelics till now, but you just dropped it. And because, you know, when we actually originally wanted to talk, it was because there was this big psychedelic conference happening in Denver, where, you know, obviously psychedelics are huge. Like, we just sort of legalized them in Colorado, and it's going to be the therapeutic mainstream. MDMA is right on the verge of FDA approval. Mushrooms, ketamine, everyone does ketamine apparently right now. There are obvious connections between what you're learning, what your research is on meditation, and what we might see in psychedelics, right? In psychedelic research. Right now, we're so excited that if you do mushrooms, you're going to get rid of your mother problems. You're going to face your family issues. And at the end of that, you're going to become what? Better? All right. Where are we going, Willoughby?
I mean, there are so many parallels. And I think, you know, one of them is just when people are enthusiastic about something, it could be a treatment, it could be whatever, new food, who cares? Like, when some people are really enthusiastic about it, they get loud about it. You see that, you know, they talk about it. They share about it with other people. But the people who don't like it, you know, who they tend to just not say anything. And so it gets the sort of effects get amplified in a very asymmetrical way. Mm-hmm. And then when you have people who are being like really harmed by something, and so now they're traumatized. And so they don't even have the wherewithal and the like capacity to speak up, because speaking up would be, they're already so dysregulated that they're basically just spending all their time managing their symptoms. They don't have time to like confront whoever gave them this treatment or the therapist or the meditation teacher or whatever. So I think that, you know, continues to happen over and over again in different industries. And it's happening in the meditation industry. It's happening in the psychedelic industry. So those are really common. Those are common across all industries. And those are sort of the most obvious parallels. But I think that the salvific altered state.
The, you know, what? I've never heard that word.
The altered state of consciousness that's going to solve all your problems.
Okay.
Is another common story, narrative that you hear in both meditation and psychedelics, that their therapeutic mechanism, the way they act, their mechanism of action is for you to sort of annihilate your sense of self and, to borrow the words from Jim Morrison, break on through to the other side, and then all is good and everything's going to be awesome. And like, you can just choose like what that's going to look like, you know.
Jim Morrison's story ended really well too, as we all remember.
Maybe if he really died. I mean, who knows if that's actually true.
I mean, I think you put it really well. I mean, I know people here in Denver now, because Denver is, I feel like it's like the hot spot. There's probably California, Denver, Oregon, where this is happening at sort of accelerated rates. I know people now who will go to an ayahuasca retreat every 2 weekends or every week, right? And if they're not doing that, they're going to try ketamine and maybe there's going to be some MDMA. And they keep on having these peak experience after peak experience. And when they relate, they say, I'm dealing with all of my issues, and that person hasn't dealt with their issues, but I have. But I look from an outside perspective. I'm like, well, have you changed as a person? Like, have we seen you're becoming a more empathetic person? Are you becoming, you know, more honest or more, you know, whatever positive trait you want to throw there? Am I actually seeing personality change? And I can't say that I am in a lot of these people. Like, I know that I've had psychedelic experiences, which I rate as some of the most profound experiences of my life. And maybe there was some change to it for sure, but I'm not seeing in the therapeutic context, the, wonder story that we do talk about. In fact, like what you're saying with the Dark Knight Project, you know, another experience that I had, a friend of mine's experience, she did mushrooms with a therapist locally. I don't think they were licensed. And she saw ghosts while on mushrooms. And the therapist said, well, those ghosts are real and you need to learn to deal with them. And then she couldn't sleep for a year because she was haunted by ghosts. What are we doing? Like, what is it? What is this world? Like in the 60s and the 70s, we have this idea of like these acid trippers, these who then never came back to reality. And it seems to me that we haven't learned that lesson incredibly well.
I mean, to your point about if these technologies, let's call them collectively, meditation and psychedelics, really were this transformative thing that could turn people into enlightened beings of endless compassion, wouldn't have happened already? Mm-hmm. I mean, LSD and psilocybin is like not new. Mm-hmm. Like it might be new in the research world and it might be making a resurgence, but like people didn't stop doing it just because it was illegal. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been people that have been doing in ayahuasca, you know, like this has been going on continuously for millennia. I don't see a huge, you know, upsurge of well-meaning, compassionate, good people coming out of that world. And I can tell you the ones that, you know, in meditation, you know, the fact that I have, you know, 1,000 emails of hate mail tells you that I don't know. I'm not particularly impressed.
That's fascinating. And of course, we're going to get more hate mail at the, you know, in the comments to this video, right? Because there's going to be people who hear these words and want to believe a reality that their own reality or a collective reality in their social group that has been reinforced by not only ideology, but also economics, right? Also these million and billion dollar companies. I don't think there's a $1 billion psychedelic company yet, but there is one with a market cap of $400 million out of Boston, I mean, that I read about yesterday.
The thing with psychedelics though, I mean, the difference is that they actually, it's very easy to continue to say meditation has no side effects. I mean, even with all of my research and all mm-hmm. of these teachers that say, yep, there can be problems, that still continues to be a very popular narrative. Not so in psychedelics. There isn't a single credible person that will say it has no side effects. I mean, all the researchers, all the wise people, you know, who have been around are saying, yes, there can be risks. And, right. you know, some That's of the fine. Same brand defense strategies are being applied. Like it only happens to people with, you know, a psychotic pre-existing tendencies, which is also not true. But you know, I do think the psychedelic world and researchers have been more responsive to the possibility of there being risks and do take it more seriously. So in some ways, the psychedelic world is a little ahead of the meditation world in terms of dealing with risks. But the every issue that was happening in meditation, which was just like the market share, like how many billions of dollars are we talking? How big is this industry? How invested are people? How much, you know, craze? It's more than hype. It's like craze. How much like energy is behind it? All of that is meditation on steroids when it comes to psychedelics. The market share is just like astronomical. So it's every single issue that is in meditation is just being amplified, just, I don't even, 1,000-fold.
Yeah. Well, and you'll probably see people deploy meditation techniques while they are on psychedelics, right? You know, to heighten the experience in order to get deeper. Because one of the interesting things about psychedelics, it's not just a physical mechanism, right? It's not like your neurotransmitters transmitted in a better way or a more, you know, fundamental way. It's also you're bringing cognitive tools to it. And I believe those cognitive tools mixing with whatever's going physiologically, plus the experience that the psychedelic brings in, is where, if there is a possibility for beneficial training, it's all of those contexts coming in at once.
Well, did you hear my podcast with Tim Ferriss that I just finished?
No, I didn't. I didn't even know you were on him.
Oh, it just came out. So Tim, I heard through the grapevine, or I guess he had talked about it on other podcasts, that he being the way he is, you know, kind of like a fairly like aggressive, you know, self-cultivator. Mm-hmm. He decided to go on retreat at Spirit Rock and start fasting a week beforehand and do psychedelics while on mm-hmm. the retreat. It didn't go well.
Hmm. What happened?
And so, well, you can listen to him tell the story, but that's why I got to be on the podcast, was because he is actually now sort of dialing back, giving a public service announcement to be like, hey guys, that approach to like combine all your powerful tools at once, like you can actually go off the rails. I did. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we basically decided to make a public service announcement together because no one listens to me. You know, like right? They'll listen to Tim because he's, yeah. you know, like he's kind of like the king of this kind of this culture that does things all over the top. And this is one of the things that you don't want to do over the top. Like don't the heroic mm-hmm. dose of psychedelics, like,
you know, actually, you know? Big shout out to Tim on this, because, you know, he is someone who tries things. And I think we do need, as humans, one of the beauties of being alive is that you get to try things and see how they work. And I think that's a generally a good personality trait to have, with some caveats here and there. But it also seems that he is able to pull back and assess something that he has tried, because he was also very instrumental in, for instance, the Wim Hof method becoming huge, because you know, Wim Hof is giant. But then after that came out, he started realizing that people were drowning and dying, you know, on his show, Josh Waitzkin, who was the chess prodigy from Searching for Bobby Fischer, almost drowned doing this. And he was like, oh, actually, we have to like walk back a little bit and balance the amazing things in these techniques with yep. the potential dangers that are there. And it's not to say that anything is good or bad with like sort of like a binary, but instead saying that these things are powerful is a better way into it, right? These are powerful things, and power can go either which way, how it's channeled, how it's used. And
but admitting that there's risk and taking responsibility mm-hmm. is incredibly rare. In fact, Tim
yes.
and Sam Harris.
Mm, yes.
I mean, actually Dan Harris too, the other Harris. But Sam Harris also has his app waking up was causing problems. And he actually reached out to me and then also allowed me to read emails from people having problems with his app that had written me. He allowed me to read those on his podcast.
Wow.
So he's allowing me to, you know, publicly criticize his product as not perfect. You know, shout out to Sam as well.
Yeah.
I am not seeing that from really anyone else, that yeah. kind yeah. of behavior.
Usually it's this protectionism, like the things that you were saying with, you know, protecting your market, protecting your brand, and then blaming the patient for doing something wrong.
Or that blaming the messenger. Yeah, the whistleblower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, you and me are just like fighting this all the time, I'm sure, because like I am now so public about drownings with Wim Hof, right? I've collected 20 deaths, and it just, the numbers are just mounting all the time. And it's so funny, because when I began this, and I think when you began your research too, it was to save the thing that you loved, right? It was to go in there and be like, look, no, there's something really good here. We want to protect it. We want the good things to be accentuated, but you have to face the negative consequences. You have to like deal with them and try to like make things better. And that is not a message that I think the community, you know, there aren't a lot of famous truth tellers in the world. I don't know if you've noticed this. There's not a lot of people who are out there who like focus on telling the truth and then their careers benefit because of that. Like, that's why we have like whistleblower laws, because whistleblowers always get into trouble with the powers that be and the audience of that the whistleblower. Well,
and anyone who thinks that, like, I mean, you've written a couple books. Like, if anyone thinks I'm getting rich by being me, like, think again. And if you think I'm having fun and I'm enjoying it, like, think again. In fact, like, I built an off-grid cabin in the mountains of Vermont, undisclosed, you know, location.
Oh, it's in New Hampshire. Willoughby, you live in New Hampshire, yeah, last New Hampshire, I remember. New Hampshire.
Virginia, maybe. because, like, it's completely taken a toll on me to be able to try to speak up over and over again, and just to get – it just takes a toll. Like, people just always – you know, yeah, but, like, it just, it's just,
it's hard. It's hard, but you know, it's, I think it's really, really important that you're doing what you do do. Because if we don't have people like you, if we don't have people going out there trying to gently look at things from, not from a slanderous perspective, but from a fact-based perspective, I think that that is the only way that you protect the things that we love, right? That that you actually protect the things that, because you're not doing this because you hate meditation, right? You went into this because you were the meditator, right? You were meditating in Arizona and you saw these negative things. And we have to, like, one of the problems in the world in general, so much bigger than what the meditation question we're talking about, is that we don't have a shared reality anymore. Like we as humans are social beings. We are not Vulcans, right? We move with our pack because evolutionarily moving with your pack was going to get you, let you survive a hell of a lot better than it was to be like, well, pack, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing this bad thing. That person got ostracized and kicked out, even if they were morally right. But we now live in a society that's so big and so complex that if we can't share a reality, if we can't admit what's actually going on, you end up in a situation where, well, bad things can happen. And bad things do happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm also just not sitting around like saying bad things can happen. I have people calling me every day. I mean, my waiting list is like 3 months long because there's so many people that are having problems with meditation that need to come. And I see someone every single day. I see one a day because that's about all I can handle.
So let's actually get into that for a little bit. Cheetah House is, you know, you are the only person that I really know who's doing this at a high level, like looking into the dark. I know you have co-authors and there are other people there, but like, let's say somebody is experiencing the dark side of meditation or psychedelics. What resources are out there for those people?
So for meditation, there is an organization that I founded called Cheetah House. And really it was when we published the first paper of the Varieties of Contemplative Experience study, and, you know, went online, there were so many people that started calling the lab saying, like, that's happening to me. I need help. And we're like, well, labs don't really do that. That's like not what universities do, you know? And so I had to start a separate entity, nonprofit called Cheetah House, in order to handle the volume and have that be kind of the dissemination and service branch of the lab. So Cheetah House does all the taking care of people and educating, trainings, that kind of thing. So at Cheetah House, if you're having problems, you can sign up for a consultation with any member of our care team. And the care team is made out of me and other researchers on the VCE study, other co-authors, and or people who have had lived experience of meditation-related challenges themselves. And so everyone is probably, like, you know, the core of the top experts on this topic are on our care team. And so you can sign up for a consultation with that. We also have support groups, and there are also lectures where we invite different researchers and people to come talk about different topics, which is, I do some of my papers that nobody reads. I will have a conversation with my husband about them, and we kind of read them and explain them to people so you don't have to read them. But yeah, Cheetah House is kind of the go-to for all meditation-related challenges.
And are you, you said you have like a 3 month waiting list. Do there need to be more Cheetah Houses? Do we need Leopard House 2 and other ones coming out there? Or can a therapist, your general therapist out there, can they also handle these questions? Or do you really need a sort of a specialist?
I mean, there is some specialty information. Unfortunately, I mean, it's a very common narrative that I hear when people come to Cheetah House, they've been through 10 meditation teachers, 2 neurologists, and 5 therapists. Like, because, you know, all of those people are still like, oh, meditation can't have side effects. It must be you, you know? And they get misdiagnosed with all sorts of things, or they've never heard of this before. Or they're like, you know, often the meditation teachers will be like, you need to meditate in order to work with this. Or, you know, do you know about mindfulness? And they're like, ugh.
Oh my God.
So there does need to be a little bit of education around it. And so we do educate clinicians and therapists and meditation teachers as well. But yeah, it would be great if there were a whole species of clinicians. I mean, we decided to do a peer support model. So we're not a clinical model, even mm-hmm. though a lot of people on our care team do have clinical degrees. That's mm-hmm. not the model that we're using, because for one reason, because a lot of the people that come feel traumatized by the power that's been exerted over their own narrative. Mm-hmm. Like when I was talking about like who gets to interpret your experience, mm-hmm. that you know, feeling like their agency has been taken away by either the biomedical, you know, mm-hmm. industry or the spiritual industry. That can happen mm-hmm. in both, you know, both kinds of interpretations. And so we decided to kind of try to level out the power hierarchy by having a peer support model rather than a clinical model. Because clinical would be like, well, I'm the expert, I know, let me tell you. Mm-hmm. And the peer model is like, hey, that happened to me too. Like, mm-hmm. how are you doing? How are you interpreting it? Where do you want to go from here? Do you want right. to hear my story? You know, kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's much more empowering to have peers, right? You know, because if it just does come from the authority, this is normal. Like that can be a useful message to hear for sure. But it's also, when you feel like there is a community of people who've had these issues, that is where the empowerment comes from. Could you give me like an idea of like what numbers we're actually talking about who end up on this dark side of enlightenment? Like, I know you've got a 300, what was it? You say 5,000 or 300 pages on experience?
Oh, 3,000 pages of interview transcripts. Yeah.
Right. So can you give like, an understanding of what the scale of this problem actually is?
So I did a epidemiological study with Simon Goldberg and Richie Davidson. So it's two of the most, you know, respected meditation researchers in the world. And a couple different data points came out of that study. One was that we wanted the denominator to be the lowest possible denominator, which would be anyone who's ever meditated even once. Mm-hmm. And so that number was 49% of the US. So basically half of all people in the US have tried meditation even once. Wow, that's mm-hmm. a lot. That's the highest number so far. Mm-hmm. The second number was that half of those people, so everyone who's half of the people that try meditation even once, will have at least one meditation-related adverse effect. And it might be something like extremely transient and no big deal, but it's not zero. So, mm-hmm. you know, half of all people. But the number that really jumped out at me was 1 in 10 people that have tried meditation at least once will have a meditation-related adverse effect that's associated with impairment in functioning. 1 in 10.
Wow. That's when you say impairment in functioning, what does that mean? Like, does that mean I'm stuttering for months, or what does that look like?
Well, I mean, in that particular study, we didn't necessarily define what that meant. The person mm-hmm. had to decide whether that applied to them or not. In the VCE study, we did ask those questions, and people have, you know, everything from I had to take, I had to drop a class because I couldn't carry a class of 5 classes, or I had to take a leave from school, or I had to take a leave from work, or I was hospitalized for a month, or I had my children taken away from me. So it can go like all the way like to the worst possible case scenario. And it can also be like, you know, even I'm actually a mindfulness teacher, and I taught in a clinical trial, and we had retreats in that clinical trial, and we had adverse effects that I found out about later. But one of them was that on the retreat day, a number of people after meditating all day felt like kind of spaced out.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. they didn't feel safe to drive. Mm-hmm. They didn't tell me because I'm the teacher.
Right.
They didn't want to tell me. So they were walking around, you know, Brown University trying to sober up before they drove home. So that's a really good example of like something, it's not a big deal, that didn't really, you know, it lasted maybe like an hour, but they just felt mm-hmm. kind of not 100% to drive.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. What do you think the flip side is of that equation? If 10% of people have a negative effect, what percentage of people have a positive or an overwhelmingly positive effect?
I mean, I think the numbers are positive enough to have it always be something that's worth a try. You know, like my general kind of recommendation, contrary to popular belief that I'm like just a hater of all things meditation, I do think it's worth a try for most people, you know, in small doses with reputable programs to like give it a try. I don't think we know. I mean, that's just not the way that data are represented. So often data, again, are represented by averages, and there's going to be people that have really, really strong effects, people that have no change, and then people who have negative effects, and they're all mushed there together. And if you're, if you're more positive effects are more positive than they are negative, then it appears like your treatment, quote unquote, works, or you get, quote unquote, significant, statistically significant results, but that doesn't tell you like what the ratios are. And this is actually a problem for, you know, translating scientific data into individualized protocols for clinicians, like to be actually applying the research. And so actually a number of really high-end journals are requiring them to display the data differently. And it's called a reliable change index. And it's so smart. It's just like, well, what proportion of your group that got the treatment got like significantly better? And what proportion like didn't get, you know, didn't change at all? And what proportion got significantly worse? And just have those numbers for every single outcome. Like, okay, that was so easy. Why doesn't everyone do that? Right. But that's not, you know, and so instead, we just, when you get the P is less than 0.05 number, you're like, oh, the meditation work, quote unquote, works. Yeah. And then it, you have this idea that like it worked for everyone in the group, but that's not what happens. And like, there's actually data, I've seen data sets, including my own, where it was like four people had these miraculous life-changing events.
Right.
And they just skewed all the data. And so I got huge effect sizes.
Right.
But yeah, there are lots of people that were like, eh, that was fine. Like,
yeah, most people are probably, eh, is fine with anything that they do. You know, even probably people who do like, I don't know, I was going to say like, what do people always have a universal chocolate, right? People who eat chocolate, there's going to be a lot of people like, eh, meh. You know, even though chocolate's pretty good in the world. It's interesting you say that because, you know, I noticed this in the comments on my these Wim Hof videos I do, where obviously there's, you have these cases of people who are like, yeah, my autoimmune illness went away, my cancer went away. I mean, you have these like huge, like big effects that are attributable supposedly to the Wim Hof method. And maybe like there's some science there. I'm not going to delve into that right now. But then there's these other people who are, most people are probably like, I did a couple ice baths and some breath work, but then I went on to something else. And then there's the downside of people who are like, I got permanent tinnitus from this, and it never went away. And again, in the comments on those videos, it's always, but this cured cancer. This cured some guy's autoimmune illness. This, you know, did this guy's crippling suicidal anxiety. It went away. And like,
well, and this is the problem with the asymmetrical representations, because you're only going to see these positive outliers, but if you're going to play that game, then you really need to see the negative outliers too. Like they all need to be up there. And, but the truth is actually most often way in between those. Right.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Most people are probably meh to everything. Like, yeah, it was cool. You know, that's why only 50% of America has tried this, because, you know, the other 50% was doing other things. Like they had to go, you know, take care of their kids. They couldn't get to meditation that day. And that was more beneficial for them. Willoughby, this is such a fascinating conversation. I feel like we're going to chat again, because I have a plan for talking to you again. And I'm going to tell you after I turn this off, because I can't tell the people on the podcast what I actually plan. Okay. Thank you so much for talking to me. And for everyone who wants to find you, you can Google Willoughby Britton and it will come up. You can Google Cheetah House and it will come up. But what's your URL that you want people to specifically go to?
Yeah, definitely go to Cheetah House. If you Google me and you write me, it might be years before I get back to you, because I get a lot of emails. So.
I can attest. This is absolutely true. Willoughby takes at least 3 weeks to respond to an email.
Yeah. Don't do that. Because a lot of the ones that I get are like, oh my God, please help me now. And I'm like, okay, that one goes first. So you're never going to get to me. You just go to Cheetah House. We'll take, you know, go there first. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, everyone, go to Cheetah House. Thank you so much for tuning into this. I think this was a really, really important conversation. Share it with somebody who you think needs to hear it, because apparently 1 out of 10 people need to hear this. 1 out of 10 people need to hear this. Thanks, Willoughby. Really love being here.